The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Craig Venter is one of the world's leading biologists. He's made numerous invaluable contributions to genomic research, and he's a pioneer in the emerging field of synthetic biology. In May 2010, he made headlines around the world after creating what he called the world's first synthetic life form. He put together an artificial chromosome and inserted it into a single-celled bacterium. Venter was a good choice then as the man to update a very influential lecture in the history of biology. In 1943, the physicist Erwin Schrödinger spoke in Dublin in a series of talks called What is Life? These were published a year later in a book and focused on one important question. How can the events in space and time, which take place within the spatial boundary of a living organism, be accounted for by physics and chemistry? Schrödinger's lecture inspired James Watson and Francis Crick in their work on discovering the double helix structure of DNA. In turn, that kick-started the field of molecular biology. Craig Venter went to Dublin recently to update Schrödinger's lecture in a talk titled What is Life? A 21st Century Perspective. Okay, so Dr. Venter, can you start by maybe just telling us what the Schrödinger lecture was in 1943, what it was and how you came across it and how it influenced you?
Well, I, like most biologists, read Schrödinger's What is Life? I've read it multiple times throughout my career, obviously reread it a couple times for doing this lecture. But you know, it was kind of clear. We had Jim Watson there last night. Watson and Crick both said Schrödinger's book totally influenced them to look for the structural part of genetics. Schrödinger predicted most of what happened, and that's why we even refer to it. You know, it's, if he'd been wrong, there are a lot of books by people that were totally wrong that have no impact, and people don't talk about them 70 years later. But he predicted that the genetic code could be as simple as the Morse code. And our digital world is just ones and zeros. He said it could have been a dot and a dash, like Morse code, at its simplest form. This was when people thought that proteins were the genetic material. So I think it's shown that people can think of things in a reasonable fashion, but there's still people, as you saw at the press conference yesterday, that still want things to be much more complex. But everything in your computer runs off of ones and zeros. So music does, every television, everything works off of that. So somehow it doesn't seem complex enough for people because they don't understand all the combinations you can get.
So Schrödinger was a physicist. What was he doing trying to explain life through physics? I mean, isn't that a biologist's realm?
Yeah. Well, look, I'm not a Schrödinger scholar. I'm just a fan of his. But from what I read, he had a lot of biological influences in his life, and he hung out with well-known biologists at the time. And I think all physicists sooner or later in their career tried to think of how to explain the world around them in physical principles.
So 70 years later, you're in the same city that Schrödinger gave his lecture in, Dublin, and you were asked to update the lecture. I mean, it's a bit of a monumental task. How did you choose to go about it?
Well, I decided instead of reviewing everything that Schrödinger wrote about and did, there's been entire conferences on that. There's been multiple books written about it. His book and its influence has been analyzed probably more than most. It seemed redundant and boring to take that approach. So I've decided to talk about what's happened in the 70 years since he wrote that. Schrödinger started his lecture with asking the question, can physics and chemistry explain life? And he said at the time it couldn't, but he expected in the future there was no reason why it couldn't. I tried to give an explanation last night that If we don't have a full picture, we're pretty darn close to it.
So tell us what we have learned in those 70 years. Now, I know that's an incredibly large question, but give us a potted two-minute history of what do we know now that Schrödinger, what's the big thing that we know now that Schrödinger didn't know?
Well, the year his book was published is when Avery published his paper showing that DNA was actually the genetic material. We learned a few years later that proteins are comprised of linear amino acid chains. Then in 53, obviously, Watson-Crick showing the basic alpha helical structure of DNA and how that could be self-replicated. So a summation of what we know is we know the linear genetic code codes for a linear protein code. That linear protein code determines how fast a protein folds, what it folds into, and what its function is, and how fast it gets degraded. So all the components of the hardware of the cell are controlled directly by the genetic code. And if you change the genetic code, you can change whether a protein works, what it does, how fast it folds, whether it gets degraded quickly. So all the things that regulate the cell now are 100% traceable to the linear genetic code. And we prove that by synthesizing the genome, putting it into a cell and having a cell that every molecule in the cell derived from that linear code. So the circle's been completely closed with our work 2 years ago.
Now, in the 70 years since that lecture, as you said, there's all these discoveries have led to the development of molecular biology, which is one of the most exciting fields in science at the moment, and it's a field that you're leading. You mentioned the work you did 2 years ago. Now, that was to create a synthetic genome and put it into an existing cell. Introduce for us what that proved, because it was the first time someone had done that.
So it proved, in fact, that DNA, as I describe it, is the software of life. So putting that new DNA into a cell, it completely converted one species into another. So the new cell that derived from the synthetic DNA had not one single molecule of the original cell. Everything in that cell came from the synthetic chromosome we put in the cell. So it really proves unconditionally that DNA is the software of life. And that everything in the cell derives from the genetic code. A lot of people wanted to think that the cell itself was the most important thing, and there's researchers in labs in different parts of the world, Italy, others trying to make what they call artificial cells just by putting proteins in lipid vesicles. Obviously, now that just seems silly, because without the genetic code to create the new proteins that die within seconds to minutes, you can't have life. In fact, if you want to kill a cell, you take out its DNA.
So the discovery you just talked about was published in the journal Science in May 2010. We're just over 2 years later. What have you been doing since then?
I get that question. So what have you done for us lately? It's been 2 years since you created life. Look, I had teams of about 400 scientists and staff, both at the our not-for-profit Basic Research Institute, the Venture Institute, and also at Synthetic Genomics. And the teams are working diligently in numerous areas, but in the synthetic genomic area, we're trying to design the first other species totally designed in the computer. And we're in the process of now synthesizing the chromosome to see if our design works. So once we make the DNA, we'll transplant it into a cell like we did 2 years ago and see if it results in a new life form.
So the interesting thing is that the difference there is the publication 2 years ago was recreating something that already existed in nature. Now you want to create something that doesn't exist in nature.
Well, what we did 2 years ago was something that doesn't exist in nature, but it was about 90% based on a living cell. And the point was, it took us 15 years to get to that point to prove that proof of concept actually worked.
So
if you ask most scientists, they would have predicted that experiment wouldn't have worked, of transplanting a genome and getting a new cell. Just because even though it's been about 60 some odd years since Watson and Crick discovered the structure of DNA, there's still a lot of people sort of clinging to the notions that existed when Schrödinger Schrodinger gave his lecture that, you know, somehow there's magical powers associated with proteins or the cells. And, you know, reductionist science has now broken things down, as Schrodinger wanted to do, to the basic components that we really understand the molecules of life. You know, creating a new species that never existed before seems actually a trite thing to me. The experiment we did as the proof of concept is the one that will change everything going forward. So whether it's a new species or not is really irrelevant. We actually wanted to have something that we knew would have a chance of working with all the millions of odds against it working in the first place. So, but we are trying to see if we can design. The goal is not just to design a new species. We're trying to get down to a minimal cell to understand the minimal molecular components of life.
So the life forms you're designing in the computer, or rather your teams are designing, tell us a bit about those. What kinds of things are you engineering them to do, and how close are you to actually making them living?
Well, we're trying to engineer them to live. Nobody knows all the absolute components to make a minimal living cell. What are the sets of genes that are absolutely essential for life? And the reason we don't know that, scientists can't get money from governments or funding agencies to actually study the unknown. So even in the minimal cell, there's about 100 genes. The only thing we know about them is if you take them out, the cell dies. We don't know what their function is yet. So it tells you about the state of modern science. Even the tiniest cell on the planet, about a quarter of the genes are of unknown function. So when you jump to the human genome, we probably know less than half of the genes and what they actually do.
And so in your experiments then, to create a minimal life form, how do you know whether when you knock something out or take away a gene that it's not that it's actually something that's very functional and necessary, rather than it's something that is just required for that particular environment?
Well, so that's what we talked about a little bit yesterday. Life is conditional. And so there's no such thing as the minimal cell. All life is environmentally relevant. So if there's not oxygen in the environment, we as a species wouldn't do too well for very long. These minimal cells have to have the media that they grow in contains sugars for them to grow on, and they have to be specific sugars, so we have the right transport molecules in the membrane to transport those sugars in. Instead of manufacturing their own amino acids, they get it all by feeding on what's in the environment. So if the environment didn't have sugar or amino acids for food, things that we get by eating sugar, fruit, meat, you know, these cells would not survive. So I also talked last night about Methanococcus eunuchii. It's the first archaea that we sequenced in 1996. It's an autotroph. It makes everything from inorganic constituents. So its carbon source is CO2. Its energy source is hydrogen. So everything is very much contextually dependent on the environment where it lives.
Now, what does a synthetic life form look like? If you ask someone to imagine one, they might just think it looks like a normal life form, a cell perhaps, with a synthetic chromosome, and it multiplies and it's been programmed to do something specific. But do you need all of the bits of a cell? Do you need to create everything? What kinds of life forms do you envisage when this technology really gets going?
So we're trying to design at Synthetic Genomics, the company, new cells to accomplish specific tasks, either making new kinds of food molecules. We're trying to create energy from carbon dioxide and photosynthesis. So the notion is that life is a DNA software-driven system. And so we don't have to design all the components in the cell. We just have to write the new software, and the cell makes everything based on what that software tells it to do. I mean, it may sound like an oversimplification of how life works, but at the fundamental levels, it works remarkably simply. The same way your computer or iPhone works. There's a set of instructions on the DNA. Those instructions build all the protein components. The proteins are the functional parts. Just one single protein makes up about 1/4 of everything in your body, and that's collagen. We have a range of proteins, so our hardware is proteins. And the instructions tell the cells which hardware to make. So it's at one level, I think Schrodinger would have loved it, that it's a pretty simple concept, very much along the lines of what he proposed in 1943.
You're reducing the abilities of a life form down to simply information, and the information is the sequence of the base pairs of your genome. Mm-hmm. To me, that sounds like you can do almost anything you like with that. Well, what's the limitation to the functionality of something like that?
Well, right, and I think you're correct. Probably we're limited more by our imaginations than anything else. But booting up that software is probably the hardest part. So right now we use one recipient cell, but the cell has to have the machinery and the proteins that recognize that particular DNA. So mycoplasmas actually use a slightly different genetic code than we do. And so trying to put human DNA in the cell and boot it up wouldn't work because it reads the genetic code a little bit differently. That's one of the reasons why we chose it. So getting the right system to boot up the software, You have a Mac. Trying to run PC software on your Mac doesn't work. You have to have the right combination of software and hardware. So I think that's going to be the challenge for scientists. Trying to design new systems is finding the right way to boot up their DNA software.
A lot of the analogies you use are software-based, they're computer-based, which lends itself to me asking, where are we in the sort of evolution of computing with synthetic genomics? At what stage are we in big mainframes and things, or how close are we to iPods and iPhones and that kind of thing?
Well, I think the computing analogy goes only so far. People have tried to recreate life in the computer, and they've been trying to do that since von Neumann built the first large computers, and they've not been very successful in doing that. So what they do have, what life and computers have in common, is they're driven by the same type of code. It's a set of instructions that drive things. And von Neumann actually suggested he could build a self-replicating machine. But there's something much more dynamic about our cells than the computers, because the software immediately drives the production of the cellular hardware. Instructions in the computer instruct the computer to carry out certain calculations and tasks, not just doing those by making transistors and other components. The physical hardware already exists in the computer. So the analogies only go so far. But the digital world and the biological world now are totally interfaced. So the cell we built started with digital code in the computer, and 4 bottles of chemicals, we turned that digital code into the analog code of DNA and booted that up in a cell, the same way you'd boot up software. But the other thing we talked about is we can now send biology at close to the speed of light as electromagnetic waves, just like you get email. And that's what we did with the flu virus. The U.S. government sends us an email with a test sequence in it, so we get that at the speed of light. It's a little bit kludgy right now turning that back into biology, but it doesn't take months. It's now down to less than 12 hours to convert that digital signal back into a flu virus.
Let's talk about that a little bit more. It sounds very tantalizing, the idea that if you design some sort of synthetic genome in the future, you'd be able to email it to someone as an attachment, and they plug that code into a machine, like a software program again. I keep going back to that. And then some box on their, a printer essentially, on their on the top of their desk prints out a life form. Is that the kind of, is that ridiculous to suggest?
No, that's in fact what we're in the process of building right now. So the analogy I used last night, it's like the telephone. So the telephone converts a digital signal into sound that we can hear with our ears. So it's a digital to analog converter. We're building a digital to biological converter. So right now we have a system that takes the digital signal, makes the DNA, and immediately in that system makes protein. So you could email somebody a protein, basically. We can also make vaccines, as we've done with the flu virus. And essentially that's what we did with the first synthetic cell. We got the digital code out of the computer. It took us a while longer than 12 hours to do, but that process is getting shorter and shorter. So that within a few years, you could actually email somebody a living cell, and there'll be a little box next to your computer that's the digital to biological converter. And that could be very important. You know, a vision I have is if there's a future pandemic, instead of waiting 9 months like we did for H1N1 vaccines to get out, maybe each home will have their own little box, and you just download the vaccine off the internet.
Tell me what this digital to biological converter looks like at the moment, and how long before it's actually something that people are using regularly, and maybe not individuals, but maybe science labs.
Yeah. Well, right now it's a device or set of devices about three times the size of this 3-foot by 3-foot table. So it's not a compact device that would be easily plugged into your computer in your kitchen. But we're working on miniaturizing all the components, and that's sort of the easy thing to do now with doing microchannels and things. So eventually I envision it'll be a very small box, but it takes the digital signal, converts it into the analog DNA software, and that software can either drive protein synthesis or drive actually making a virus or the organism.
Tell us a bit more about your work with the U.S. government on the flu vaccines. Now, you're working with them and the pharmaceutical company Novartis. What is it that you're helping them with precisely?
Well, we're trying to greatly shorten the time to get a new vaccine made. So with H1N1, had the pandemic been as bad as was expected, tens of millions of people could have died before the vaccine became available. It was about 9 months after the pandemic started before there was a good vaccine. In fact, a lot more people died from this than it was expected. I think it's been about 230,000 now is the latest estimate. And they're mostly relatively young people because us older guys and gals had some prior immunity from earlier viral infections. So instead of waiting 9 months, we're using our synthetic DNA capabilities to actually make the new vaccine components in less than 12 hours. We get those to Novartis, and Novartis has a large plant in North Carolina for scaling up production of vaccine versus the way we've been doing it for centuries, it seems, growing a virus in chicken eggs. So it's turning into a much more biological production system where the time will be much, much faster for the next pandemic. We're already, and Novartis is already, and the U.S. government is pandemic ready. We're actually trying to turn it into the annual flu vaccine because we're using the sequencing of flu virus around the world, and my institute is one of the major centers sequencing the flu virus, tracking its evolution. Tracking it not just in humans, but in pigs and chickens, which was a combination of the bird flu and the pig flu that gave us H1N1. So we can predict in advance what the next round of infections could be from and have vaccines already sitting on the shelf waiting for those, which takes the time down from 9 months to maybe hours before something could be ready to go.
So the actual creation of the vaccine is not the difficult part. It's the growing it up. Is that right?
Well, the only process that's been approved is taking literally millions of chicken eggs, injecting virus into each one to grow up the virus in chicken eggs. I mean, it's almost like something out of a medieval comic book. So trying to get things where it can work in a much more efficient fashion. Novartis uses a mammalian cell line that is far more efficient. They can scale it up in manufacturing in one single plant to potentially produce enough doses to cover much of an infected population. But that's still a different model than what I'm proposing, and you know how long it takes to get there, where instead of waiting for a company and federal regulations and all the processes that took 9 months last time to get out a new pandemic vaccine. I don't know if you've seen the movie Contagion, but it was not a bad description of what might happen during a flu pandemic. You know, people can't really travel effectively. So if you could just download off the internet your own vaccine, that would change how we deal with things. It could essentially wipe out a pandemic before it gets going.
I'd just like to ask you about creating life forms before we finish. One of the things that has become apparent since you and others sequenced the first human genome more than a decade ago, one of the things that's become apparent is how complex the genome actually is. It's not just a bunch of genes and then lots of junk in between them. In fact, the junk, which no one really calls junk anymore, the non-coding DNA seems more and more important in creating these various RNAs and things that regulate genes. If you are creating even a minimal life form, how do you mimic that sort of complexity? Because those RNAs are incredibly important, the microRNAs.
Well, you create it by first mimicking what we know works. I mean, that's what we did with the very first cell. And even these, quote, simple cells do have microRNAs that regulate their genes and regulate their function. So that's the challenge with even trying to design a minimal cell with maybe 500 genes versus our 20,000 genes. So we're a very, very long way from trying to design a modern eukaryotic cell, certainly not a mammalian cell. Science doesn't understand most of the regulation yet that goes on. As you said, it always stunned me that people referred to the parts we didn't know what they do in the genome as junk DNA. It just shows the arrogance and thinking that slows science down very substantially. And it was great when the microRNAs were discovered and, as you said, what people are referring to as junk, and we're going to make a lot more discoveries of what's in there. So a complex mammalian genome like ours has levels of regulation. But one of the things, it is all coded for by the DNA. So it's all software driven. So it doesn't matter if the complexity in the cell from all the molecules produced has multiple layers into interactions. Obviously, that's how we function with a small amount of coding information. You recall there was a gentleman at the press conference who just didn't want to accept the small number of genes and things could go down to a code of ones and zeros. You know, it's sort of, you know, we want it to be more complex. But the combinatorial nature of these signals is why computers work. It's why we work. When you write the software, you don't have to build all these other molecules. You just have to have the software that works. When people write new software for your Mac or a PC, they don't start back with where Bill Gates and others had to start decades ago. They start with modern compilers that use the information that's accumulated over all this time. That's what's going to happen with genome design as well. We're going to use the biological compilers that tell us these components are necessary. And so if you want to design a certain function, for example, producing oil from carbon dioxide and sunlight, heat, these are the components you have to add to it. But the reality is we are in the empirical phase of biology. We've been in the empirical phase a long time. Some academics try to treat this in a fairly arrogant fashion of it's hypothesis driven, you have to have a good question. We're discovering most of the biology just going out and asking questions of what's there and finding it. So most of the discoveries that will be made in the next several decades will be based on empirical findings. We don't know what most of the genes do. We have to find a way to scale up making those discoveries several orders of magnitude faster than what's been going on. We've already discovered more genes than all the scientists on the planet could decipher in the next 2,000 years at the rate it's going. So we need to change it. Synthetic genomics will help decipher what these functions are.
I'm going to ask you to look into the deep future here, maybe many, many decades or centuries even after. You know, you're gone. As this stuff moves forward and we understand more about the basic processes of life, what the genes do, and say we characterize all these things, all of it is still based around a very simple code of 4 DNA letters. Do you ever see a time when, you know, human imagination takes that beyond 4 codes? What could we do with if there were other ways of combining DNA or adding other bases and other functions?
So we don't need to go beyond 4 letters any more than a computer needs to go beyond a 1 and a 0. That gives you an infinite number of coding possibilities. And that's, I think that's what a lot of people have trouble comprehending. And it takes a while when you think about a computer, how all the pictures, all the functions, all the movies, all the sound gets reduced to ones and zeros. So in that sense, we're much more complex than a computer. We have a 4-letter code, not a 2-letter code. And the number of combinations is virtually infinite, as we've seen. Looking at the diversity of life on this planet. So we don't need more letters in the code. There's a number of groups that have been working on creating new artificial amino acids, and those do have some potential benefit in making cells that are completely resistant to viruses as we know them. That could be very useful for industrial organisms so that they don't get wiped out by a simple viral infection. But if we could understand all the things on this planet that our 4-letter DNA software does, their knowledge base would have to be about 10,000 times larger than it currently is. So I think we can go a long way with our 4 letters.
That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. From me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.